for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Natasha Trethewey is the first U.S. poet laureate to move to Washington and work out at the Library of Congress since the position was established in 1986. She's the first Southern poet laureate since Robert Penn Warren, and she's the first person to serve simultaneously as the poet laureate of a state, Mississippi, and the nation. In 2007, she received a Pulitzer Prize for her poetry collection, Native Guard. Last year, she published a follow-up titled Thrall. Natasha Trethewey joins me in the studio. She'll talk about the role of poetry in our lives. I hope you'll call in with your own thoughts. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you. It's so good to meet you.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Tell me, considering the fact that you are both the poet laureate of Mississippi and now of the country, tell me why you made the decision to move to Washington.
Well, you know, I thought that it would be a lovely way to remind people that the post of poet laureate is a very public post. It's one that is housed in the Library of Congress, which is also a public space that we all get to go and enjoy. And I thought that for my term, it would be a great thing for me to have an opportunity to meet people in the library, to have visitors come who want to talk about poetry, who want to share their ideas with me, their thoughts about poetry, and also to give me a chance to go back to a place that means a lot to me. I did my own research in the library for my book, Native Guard. And so it's a little bit about the public persona of a poet, but also something very private and personal, the chance to work there.
So who do you expect will come to meet you at the library?
Well, you know, I've already received some messages, emails from some people who are poets or people who study poetry who are interested in just coming to see the space.
Good.
And getting
Good.
To talk about it. So I imagine a wide range of people, students maybe. I'm hoping for ordinary folks who just have an interest in poetry or want to know more about it.
And at 46, you are among the youngest of the poets laureate. Do you think that that's going to affect the way people look not only at you but at poetry itself?
Well, it might. I think that sometimes those of us who are less familiar with poets have a certain image of poetry and poets. I remember a student of mine, a young woman at Emory University, who wanted to be a poet, and yet in her mind, the image of a poet was always a man. He was always older. He wore tweed and leather, patches on his elbows. And here she was trying to be a poet, but the image in her mind, she wasn't it. There wasn't an image of herself. And so I do think that you know, when the image is different, when we can see someone else in that role, we can imagine the possibilities of ourselves there, too.
Do you think there's a certain intimidation factor with poetry?
Well, there certainly was for me when I was growing up. My father is actually one of those older guys with tweed jackets and leather patches and a professor. And I remember, you know, just sort of being the daughter of a poet, that you would think that somehow poetry would come easily or naturally to me. But at the same time, even as I listened to my father's poems and saw him at work as a poet growing up, I was still intimidated by poetry. I still thought it was something difficult to understand, less accessible to me than the short stories that I was reading and loved.
And then you said there was a poem that made you realize that there was something in poetry for you by W.H. Auden.
That's right.
Do you want to read that?
Oh, I'd love to. This is Musée de Beaux-Arts. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course anyhow in a corner, some untidy spot where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry. But for him, it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water. And the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on.
And that was the Poet Laureate of the United States, Natasha Trethewey, reading Musée de Beaux-Arts by W.H. Auden. Tell me why that poem spoke to you so.
Well, I was in college when I first encountered this poem, and it was not long after my mother died. She died a tragic death, and I remember sitting in a class, and this is one of the poems that we had to read from my literature textbook. And it was at that moment when I read those lines about suffering, they were never wrong, and the image at the end of the poem of seeing the tiny legs of Icarus as he falls into the sea to his own disaster, that I realized that really sort of encapsulated for me what I was feeling. That tiny little insignificant person over there suffering while the rest of the world goes on about its way, mm-hmm. not knowing, not seeing this other tiny little thing. And so the poem made me feel that I wasn't alone, even though it's very much about sort of being off in the distance where no one sees the suffering. It's the way poetry reminds you that someone else has felt that, meaning you're not alone in feeling that.
How did your mother die?
She was murdered by her second ex-husband.
So she and your father were divorced.
That's right. They divorced when I was six and started first grade.
And did you continue to live with her or with your father?
I lived with my mother, and I spent the summers with my grandmother and my father. I'd visit him also. My grandmother in Mississippi, and my father was in New Orleans at the time.
And your mother remarried.
That's right.
And what was that relationship like for you after she remarried?
Well, you mean my relationship with my mother?
Or... And your stepfather.
Oh, my stepfather. Well, my stepfather, I think, was always bothered by me because I was a constant reminder that my mother had been married before, that she'd been married to a white man, and I was the daughter of that marriage. And so there were always tensions in that house, of course, which reminds me of poetry yet again. I can't not think about Robert Hayden's Those Winter Sundays. Of course, it's a poem about his father and not his stepfather, but the kind of chronic tensions in a difficult household and the ways in which they shape us.
Why did he kill her?
Well, he was someone very much obsessed with her. He's a Vietnam veteran and I think came back deeply scarred, wounded from his time there. For the people who experience it as well as their families, but his diagnosis is paranoid schizophrenia. And so he had been abusing her for years. And when my mother finally was able to escape the marriage, first to a battered woman shelter, and was able to get a divorce, he continued to stalk her after that until he was able to get to her and to kill her.
Oh, Natasha, I'm so sorry. What a difficult time that must have been for you.
It was a difficult time. And you know, Diane, it sometimes it still is. There are moments when the grief of that loss seems fresh. It comes back. I think that's one of the reasons I had to write the poems in Native Guard, to deal with that ongoing sense of grief.
And when we come back after a short break, you'll hear Natasha Trethewey, Poet Laureate of the U.S. and the state of Mississippi, read from her books of poetry, both Native Guard and her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Thrall. 800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's my honor to have Natasha Trethewey here in the studio. She is at 46, among the youngest of the Poets Laureate of the United States. She is dually the Poet Laureate of the state of Mississippi. She's professor of English and creative writing at Emory University. Her third collection of poetry, titled Native Guard, received the 2007 Pulitzer Prize. Her latest collection, titled Thrall, was published just last year. Talk about the decision you made to merge the history of your mother, Gwendolyn Ann Turnbow, and the history of the Louisiana Native Guard.
Well, I don't think that I knew I was merging it at first. You know, as the poet Mark Doty says, our metaphors go on ahead of us. And the poems, of course, become an act of discovery where they show us what it is we're thinking about, what our deepest obsessions are. I began by doing the research about the Civil War soldiers, those Louisiana Native Guards, writing about them because they were stationed off the coast of my hometown, Gulfport, Mississippi. And I used to take the little boat trip every 4th of July with my grandmother to go out to the fort just to tour it and go to the beach. And there wasn't any mention of those black soldiers back then when we took the trip. And I began to think that this was one of those sort of lesser known or forgotten histories that wasn't being, even though historians, of course, were writing about it, again, those ordinary folks like me who were just taking the trip out to the fort without being able to see a monument or hear the tour guide talk about it had no idea about this history. And when I found out about it, I began to write those poems, but at the same time was writing elegies for my mother. It had been nearly 20 years since she'd been gone. I had moved back to the particular geography of my past, where that great loss, that great tragedy happened. And so I was, you know, sort of working on two things at one time, but thinking that the poems were deeply personal, putting them away in a drawer, until I realized that what linked them, what my mother had in common with those black soldiers was the lack of a kind of remembrance. No monument. My mother's grave had no monument. And so I felt that she was sort of being erased from the landscape in that way as well. Mm. And of course, there are a few other similarities. Just the idea of the kinds of civil wars that go on in our lives, from a large grand war in a nation to the civil wars of domestic violence within the home.
Read for us that poem, Monument, if you would, on page 43.
Yes. Monument. Today the ants are busy beside my front steps, weaving in and out of the hill they're building. I watch them emerge and, like everything I've forgotten, disappear into the subterranean, a world made by displacement. In the cemetery last June, I circled, lost, weeds and grass grown up all around, the landscape blurred and waving. At my mother's grave, ants streamed in and out like arteries, a tiny hill rising above her untended plot. Bit by bit, red dirt piled up, spread like a rash on the grass. I watched a long time the ants' determined work, how they brought up soil of which she will be part, and piled it before me. Believe me when I say I've tried not to begrudge them their industry, this reminder of what I haven't done. Even now, the mound is a blister on my heart, a red and humming swarm.
And that is Natasha Trethewey reading Monument, one of the poems in her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Native Guard. Tell us what it was like growing up in a family where your mother was of one race and your father another.
Well, you know, I was born in 1966 in Mississippi, and it seems like so long ago, of course, and yet the memories of living in sort of the post civil rights, post Jim Crow era of Mississippi are vivid in my mind. I remember being afraid a lot when I would travel places with my parents. I could see people looking at us in ways that made me feel uncomfortable, even threatened sometimes. When I was about 3 years old, there was a cross burned on my grandmother's lawn, and we were all sort of huddled inside the house as this went on. There were constant threats like that everywhere around us.
How did your parents react to that cross burning?
Well, you know, I think that my parents were young. They were in their 20s. It was a time in the country where, because of the civil rights movement, that young people were, you know, as they always are in some ways, energetic, and they knew that they were doing things for a righteous cause. I think that it terrified my mother. I think that she would have wanted to avoid as much as possible that kind of threat of violence and intimidation. My father, you know, is very sort of a tough guy. He might not say that he was frightened by it, but I'm sure it was sobering for us.
How did they meet?
They met in college at Kentucky State College. It's Kentucky State University now, but it's one of the historically black colleges and universities. And it's sort of a funny story how my father, a white man from Canada, ended up there. But he, both my parents graduated from high school when they were 16. And my father spent a year teaching in the one-room schoolhouse in Mount Uniacke, Nova Scotia, where he's from, and then decided to go to an American college. And he got out a guide to them to find one that he could afford, one that would also give him a track scholarship. And he got into Kentucky State and didn't quite realize that it was an all-black college, and made his way down, hitchhiking the whole way, and arrived on campus. My mother tells this lovely story about how it was when the Righteous Brothers had first come out. They had that song, "You Lost That Love and Feeling." And because of their deep and soulful voices, my mother and all the women in her dormitory thought they must be black men. And so they all gathered around the television one night because they were going to come on one of the variety shows. And my mother told me that just at that moment when these white guys come out singing in that soulful voice, that my father jogged by the window, and it was love at first sight.
Oh, my goodness. And yet, you've written a poem titled Miscegenation. Would you read that for us?
Yes.
It's on page 36.
Miscegenation. In 1965, my parents broke two laws of Mississippi. They went to Ohio to marry, returned to Mississippi. They crossed the river into Cincinnati, a city whose name begins with a sound like sin, the sound of wrong, miss in Mississippi. A year later, they moved to Canada, followed a route the same as slaves, the train slicing the white glaze of winter, leaving Mississippi. Faulkner's Joe Christmas was born in winter, like Jesus, given his name for the day he was left at the orphanage, his race unknown in Mississippi. My father was reading War and Peace when he gave me my name. I was born near Easter, 1966, in Mississippi. When I turned 33, my father said, "It's your Jesus year. You're the same age he was when he died. It was spring, the hills green in Mississippi." I know more than Joe Christmas did. Natasha is a Russian name, though I'm not. It means Christmas child, even in Mississippi.
I love that.
Thank you.
Just wonderful.
So my parents, there were two laws that they had to break, because not only was it illegal to intermarry in the state, it was also illegal to leave the state to go to a state where you could get married and then return.
So they were illegal all the way around.
That's right.
What do you think drove them apart?
Well, I think some of perhaps the same idealism and excitement that brought them together in the 60s also became part of the difficulties and disillusionment that they must have had. I mean, they were young, so like a lot of young couples, they were still changing and growing. But I think they had the added pressure of living in a very difficult time and place.
What about neighbors? How were they regarded by the people around them?
Well, it was actually a lot easier when we were in Mississippi, in my grandmother's neighborhood, which is an historically black neighborhood that's been there since after the Civil War. My father was accepted into the community. He played baseball for my great uncle's son, who had a small team. My grandmother got him a job loading crates at the shipyard on the docks. But when my father went back to graduate school in New Orleans, it was a little bit harder for my mother because that group of people that he knew saw her very much as an outsider and treated her that way.
So that when the two of them, for example, would walk out of the house with you, mm-hmm. how were the three of you regarded?
Well, in my neighborhood in Mississippi, I think that we were, by the people that we knew, well-regarded. I mean, because my father was connected to my grandmother and my great-uncle's son, who were very well-known in the community. My great-aunt Sugar, who lived next door, had helped to start the church that my grandmother lived across the street from in an arbor. And so we were very well-known people and had lots of friends. And so when you have lots of friends, you know, people can say, all right, well, we'll let him be one of us. And he was. It was when we went downtown that things were difficult.
What happened?
Well, I can remember being at a Woolworth's downtown Gulfport, Mississippi. And my father has told me this story, so sometimes I think, do I remember it or is it a memory given to me because he's repeated it so often. But my mother is doing the shopping and my father is holding me, and there are two white women who are standing not far from us saying, oh, what an adorable little thing she is. Too bad she's black. Because, of course, at that moment, at that time, they knew all the limitations that being born into that particular time and place were going to represent. Certainly, that has not necessarily been the case. We had much work to do then. We have much work to do now.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we have a number of callers. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Thank you. I really want to say congratulations on being the Poet Laureate. I was so thrilled to hear when you received this honor.
Thank you.
I have really loved, I loved reading Native Guard and Beyond Katrina. And next on my list, I have actually a list of poetry books I'm reading. So I've got to get the thrall. And I'm reading a Jim Harrison book right now.
Oh, yes.
So I really will tell you I'm really looking forward to this. My question is that artistically, what do you envision as the poet, your term as Poet Laureate? What do you, would you like to accomplish? Because I guess as an avid reader of poetry, I was thinking of Richard, the poet that was read during the inauguration the other mm-hmm. day. There were a number of people that were being shown, scanned over, and I could see faces of incomprehension.
Oh.
And I often think that, you know, poetry is actually very comprehensible.
Yes.
It's just learning how to read it. And my view is that I would like to see the Poet Laureate being used to help people to understand that poetry is for all of us. And I will take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Robert, I think you've said it. And I'm only going to sort of repeat some of the wonderful things that you've said. That's something, the idea that poetry is accessible and available to all of us and can be meaningful to all of us is something very important to me. There are many people like Robert who are avid readers of poetry and feel that they understand poetry. But there's so many people that don't. And as I mentioned before, I was one of those people when I was growing up, even though I had the resources right in my own home to connect to poetry. And so it's really important to me in this role to promote poetry to a wider audience and to bring people to it who might have gone away from it in the past because they thought it was incomprehensible or they thought it perhaps did not speak to the realities of their everyday lives. I'd like to remind people that poetry does just that, that there is a poem out there for everyone.
Natasha Trethewey, she is the Poet Laureate of the U.S. and the state of Mississippi. Her book, Native Guard, won the Pulitzer Prize. She has a new book titled Thrall. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, poet and soldier Brian Turner will read poems about his experiences in the Iraq War.
You will hear the RPG coming for you, not so the roadside bomb.
And Maureen Corrigan shares the story of discovering a 1945 letter from the Secretary of the Navy to her father after he'd retired from the Navy. Join us.
And welcome back. If you've just joined us, Natasha Trethewey, who is the 46-year-old Poet Laureate of the United States and also of the state of Mississippi. She is the daughter of a white father and a black mother. Her mother, sadly, was taken tragically. Your father, I gather, still lives.
That's right.
And where is he now?
My father is in Roanoke, Virginia. He's a professor of English and a poet at Hollins University.
How wonderful. Someone called earlier and wanted to know why the Poet Laureate is not invited to speak at large ceremonies, for example, the inaugural. Is that not something that the Poet Laureate normally does?
That's right. The Poet Laureate is actually chosen for the post by the Librarian of Congress. And so the position is rooted in the library. And so one of the things that they've done to maintain the position as it is that they don't ask the Poet Laureate to do any kind of state events. The Poet Laureate isn't expected to write occasional poems for various occasions. It's in some ways a way of keeping the poet free from doing that kind of work so that they might focus on their own projects.
What was your reaction to the poem that was read at the inauguration?
Well, I love the poem. I thought,
so did I.
I think that Richard Blanco is just a lovely poet. And what moved me most about the poem was the balance, this lovely marriage between the civic poem that is there to speak nationally to and for all of us, wed with the personal. There was a moment in the poem in which he says something like, I hate to misquote him, but that his mother rang up groceries for 20 years so that he could write this poem. There were a few other little personal moments in there, but what those personal moments do are they resonate with our own experiences, even if it's not exactly the same thing. I thought the poem was inclusive, small d, democratic in its inclusion. The perfect poem for such an occasion.
Let's go back to the phones to Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning, James.
Good morning. I'm so excited to speak with you, Ms. Trethewey.
Thank you.
And I thank you for the focus, as I understand it, of your campaign and as the Poet Laureate, and for your coming on the show this morning, which is talking about how to make poetry more accessible mm-hmm. to the wider community. I wanted to speak from my own experience briefly mm-hmm. and then ask a question. So I'm a poet myself mm-hmm. and also a grassroots organizer. Excuse me. And I'm temporarily relocated to the D.C. area myself, so I'm excited to come and visit you.
Hope you will. Thank you.
Yes. I think it's lovely that you're making an open space like that. But for 18 years, I lived in a little town called Gainesville in the north of Florida, which mm-hmm. is the University of Florida town, mm-hmm. and was involved with a weekly poetry reading through an institution called the Civic Media Center, which is an alternative library and community organizing space there. And every week for 18 years, and still to this day, every Thursday night, we have an open reading where anyone can come and share their poetry. Mm-hmm. And what I've found is that there's this tremendous gap between the poetry street and the official world of poetry, which lives primarily through academic institutions and a few venerable publications like Poetry Magazine. Mm-hmm. And what I found from talking to my fellow poets and doing the work of organizing and promoting a weekly reading was that what was most valuable to them was that sense of community, not only an audience, but an engaged audience mm-hmm. of which they were part themselves for each other's work. And to really get poetry out to working class people, not just have it be the property, this precious mm-hmm. property of academic institutions.
Yes.
And I wonder what's been your own experience with what's called the spoken word movement mm-hmm. as exemplified by the New Yorican Poets Cafe, the Deaf Poetry Jam. Mm-hmm.
All right.
I'm glad that you talked about your own experience with the weekly reading series. That's the kind of thing that really makes me happy to see. In my own town in Georgia, where I live now, there's also a lot of that going on. And just around the corner from my house, there's a place that has it on Sunday nights. And anytime you go there, the lines are out the door for people to get in, to sign up to read their own poems. And they do a kind of blend there. There's the sort of the open mic, two sets of that with an invited featured reader in the middle. And I've gone to do that a couple of times. The guy who organizes it is just a fabulous promoter of poetry in and around the Atlanta area, and it brings out a great crowd. I think you're right to say that there can feel like a great divide between what may be happening in the bars and the cafes on the streets and in the academic setting of the university. I think oftentimes people don't realize that there are many poets who participate in both of those worlds. You mentioned the New Eureka Cafe, for example, and my former professor, Martine Espada, who taught me at the University of Massachusetts, also is a poet who was very big in that scene. So he was blending a kind of, you know, academic presence with a more public presence out in you know, among the people in the streets who are doing spoken word. I think that the more we come together, the more that we see that there are things that we have in common as poets, that and as listeners of poetry, that it can only increase the health of poetry in America. And I think that the story that the caller had reminds me that poetry is doing just fine.
What about the small publications, the magazines of poetry?
Well, you know, that's where I started publishing my poems. My father, you know, sat me down and said, you know, so this is what you have to do. And he gave me all these small magazines, and that's where I started sending my poems. I still like to do it because I love supporting them. Not too long ago, I had to write a letter to one of those small magazines. It's a magazine called Cave Wall that's only been going for a couple of years. I know the people who started it, and they are committed to finding poems that are going to matter to their readers. And what I loved when I first started sending poems out many, many years ago is that I felt that the anonymity that I had was wonderful, that all you did was send your poems. The words on the page were the only things that mattered to someone who was going to open that envelope and decide whether or not to publish them. It didn't matter what you looked like or who you were or what your name was. I loved that about them. I still love that about them.
How popular, how widespread are they?
Well, I mean, every year, I think someone starts a new one, probably.
Magazine.
And you know, sometimes you hear this criticism that, you know, people are just starting these little magazines so that all of their academic poet friends will have somewhere to publish. I don't think that that's fair. I think people start little magazines because they love the words, they love, and they want to get the work of poets that they like out there to the world.
Let's go to Houston, Texas. Good morning, Anita.
Good morning. And I'm a big fan of the show, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I was struck by the similarities between what you were talking about as you grew up. My daughter is 9, and she is biracial. Mm-hmm. Her biological father is Caucasian, and her biological mother was African-American. Mm-hmm. And we are a same-sex couple raising her, so it's not legal for us to be married in the state of Texas.
Right.
And so she has these differences, and she loves art. So she loves to draw and sketch and paint. And I wondered about we encouraged her to do that, of course, to express herself. Mm-hmm. And in some environments amongst our friends, she's very comfortable, and other times, I think I worry more about how we're being perceived than she does, but I just wondered about how poetry and how your art form might have helped you to process and deal with and express the times and the significant changes mm-hmm. that you were going through as a family.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, thank you for your question. You know, I think I first turned to poetry to make sense of the history I'd been given. And in that way, it was a kind of outlet and a way to grapple with the realities of my own experience. Later on, the more I wrote poetry, it changed for me in some ways. It's still something that I absolutely have to do, But I feel like the mission is greater now than just offering comfort to myself. I feel like there are things that it's necessary for us to say to one another, for us to hear one another. And because poetry is the best way we have of reaching not only the intellect, but also the heart, because poetry creates that sense of empathy in us, it is for me now a way to speak very intimately to a reader. And I do think that, you know, the people find in art the need and the necessity and the ability to convey those most difficult and necessary things.
There is a poem you wrote in 1968 titled Help. And I think actually it references 1968 rather than having you have written it in 68. Would you read that for us?
Yes. This is a poem after a photograph from the series The Americans by Robert Frank. Help, 1968. When I see Frank's photograph of a white infant in the dark arms of a woman who must be the maid, I think of my mother and the year we spent alone, my father at sea. The woman stands in profile, back against a wall, holding her charge, their faces side by side, the look on the child's face strangely prescient, a tiny furrow in the space between her brows. Neither of them looks toward the camera, nor do they look at each other. That year, when my mother took me for walks, she was mistaken again and again for my maid. Years later, she told me she'd say I was her daughter, and each time strangers would stare in disbelief, then empty the change from their pockets. Now I think of the betrayals of flesh, how she must have tried to make of her face an inscrutable mask, and hold it there as they made their small offerings, pressing coins into my hands. How, like the woman in the photograph, she must have seemed, carrying me each day, white in her arms, as if she were a prop, a black backdrop, the dark foil in this American story.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have a number of emails. Please comment. This is from Janice. Please comment on the article in yesterday's Washington Post about the death of poetry. With practitioners like Natasha, it is hardly so. But I'm curious to hear your take on it.
You know, I actually didn't see that article, but I think that they've been proclaiming the death of poetry for a very long time, and it just keeps kicking. So I will definitely go back and read it. I think that the idea is that no one cares about poetry, no one reads poetry, and yet we know that there are thriving literary magazines. We know that audiences go out to readings all the time. I know this. We host readings at the university all the time, and lots of people come to them. Lots of people stand in line to sign up at the cafes to read their own poems. I think poetry is still very much alive, and people are finding different ways to come back to it.
And, of course, that depends a great deal, not only on the child's experience, but what he or she hears from teachers, from professors, from the world around him or her.
Right. I was thinking about some of the ways that we come to poetry when we're younger. And I remember there's a moment when you're a child and Poetry is fun because it's rhyme, it's the repetition of certain sounds, it's the pleasure of saying certain words on the tongue. All of that is just sheer delight. And then there's a moment where, and this is not true for everyone, but I think it was the case for me, that I had to learn poetry in order to answer questions on a test. And that wasn't so much fun. But when you just read a poem for sheer delight, and just allow yourself to hear it and to feel it in your own body and your own breath, then we can love poetry again.
And on that note, I want to congratulate you once more as the new Poet Laureate for the U.S. and the state of Mississippi, and also for your wonderful poetry, so vivid, Natasha.
Thank you, Diane.
I've looked at her book, Thrall, and her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Native Guard. Natasha Trethewey, thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from